Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Behind Massive Screens, a game development podcast here from Massive Entertainment in Malmo. So we started this podcast slash video project, used to be video, 2.5 years ago. It feels not like 2.5 years. Something happened with time in between start of 2020 and now. But yeah, 2.5 years ago, we recorded our first episode, and then we talked about narrative design. And since it's been so long, I thought we'd revisit the subject together with Shella, narrative designer here at Massive. Welcome.
Thank you. It's so nice. Lovely space you have here.
I know. Sadly, like the listeners can't see, but we spent a lot of energy. If you look at the trailers, I think on social, you can see.
But it's really nice. I can verify to the listeners that it's a nice little space.
It is. Oh, watch the Division 2 stream. They actually recorded in here. But yeah, welcome.
Thank you.
So nice to have you here.
It's good to be here.
I'm glad. Let's just jump right in.
Get into it.
Narrative designer on a top level. Mm-hmm. Just going to describe your job. We're going to, of course, go into specifics. Mm-hmm. But just shortly going to describe what you do.
Right. So as a narrative designer, I am responsible for the player experience in terms of how they experience the story, and also writing the dialogue for the cutscenes and for the quests. So working with a quest designer to design the quest experience from a narrative point of view.
Right. So how did you end up here at Massive? Also, I'm going through the list of questions I ask everyone, but how did you end up in Massive?
So I don't know if you want me to start from the beginning.
Just start from the beginning. Okay. We have all the time in the world.
So I did a literature degree at university, and then I did a postgrad in journalism, and I became a journalist and a freelance copywriter. So a commercial copywriter writing for PR agencies and things like that, and a games journalist at the same time. So within that role, I would present at talks and sort of, when you see people hosting panels at big sort of games events and things like that, that would be me. And then I decided to go into writing games, and I went on a week-long writing retreat with John Ingold, was one of the writers from Inkle Games. He did Heaven's Vault and 80 Days, and David Varela, they were the tutors, and then Rihanna Pratchett was one of the guest tutors. So learnt about writing for games from really, really great talented people. So it was a good start. And then from that, I signed up for a game jam at a city local to me. So I'm from the UK originally, and there was a game jam in Bristol, which is in the southwest of England. And that's where I met Claire Morwood, who would become my co-dev and co-founder of my micro indie studio called Threefold Games. And so through that, I think both my kind of renown, it sounds like overly as a journalist, but I had, sort of a profile, that's what I mean. I had a sort of social media profile, and I was speaking at lots of events. So that combination of that, and before I forget, was getting a lot of interest. People were interested in it because it was about a woman with dementia, which was unusual. And so, so then I was invited to an event for games writers, and then that's where I met the narrative director. We're looking for writers at Massive at the moment. Right. And You have to be able to move to Sweden, and I could at that point. I didn't think it was going to be a thing that I'd have to sort of a decision I'd have to really make. I was like, this is unlikely to happen, but right. It sounds kind of cool, so I'll apply for this job and see what happens. And then I got the job, and yeah, I was in shock for quite a long time. I was like, I think I'm moving to Sweden for this amazing dream job. And
how long have you been here now?
It'll be 3 years in August. Yeah, so it's like, yeah.
We're going to go right back to you, but I just want to say 80 Days is one of my absolute favorite games ever. If you're looking for a narrative game, go buy it on your phone.
Yeah,
it'll save you any flight you're on. It doesn't matter how many hours it is. That game is amazing.
Yeah, it is beautiful. Yeah, they're always great. Have you played Overboard?
Yes.
Oh my God, I love that.
I still have like one or two goals left. Mm-hmm. It's brilliant.
Game. Yeah, yeah.
Go buy all of Inkle stuff.
Yeah, just buy Inkle games.
Yeah.
This podcast is not sponsored by Inkle.
Exactly. Feel free to sponsor us, John. Anyway, let's get back into. But I want to touch on, and this is kind of a selfish thing though, because I come from a games journalist background as well. I've worked as that for quite some time. And looking at, like, you see old colleagues and old friends, like, over time, they do tend to go into the games industry, but it's typically reserved for PR communication roles. Mm-hmm. But what did you learn kind of from your journalist background? How did that kind of feed into what you're doing now?
Yeah, I mean, so I was always writing fiction on the side as well, right. Quite seriously. You know, I ran a writing group and things. So, but I think games, like as a games journalist, it kind of followed on quite neatly from my literature degree, because in that you're analyzing storytelling. And so that's what you do, you know, when you're writing reviews as a games journalist, you sort of analyzing what it's doing well. If something's doing something well, how does it do that? And how does it compare to other things? So that kind of sets you up nicely for making games, I think, because you kind of understand on a very sort of surface level, at least. You know, you don't know until you sort of actually get into making a game, you realize that you don't know what makes a great game. But you have an understanding of you know, what a good player experience is, or one that you like, one that you appreciate, at least, and how to appreciate even experiences that you don't like. You know, for instance, like a sports game or something, if I had to review that, I could appreciate a good sports game, even though it's probably not my go-to genre and things like that. And then just journalism in general, deadlines are a thing in journalism. So yeah, just being able to hit deadlines, and I guess you, within that profession, you get a... that becomes your like way of working, that you are sort of energized by those deadlines and like meeting them and things like that. And then I suppose the writing, even though it's not creative writing, you're still your voice has to adapt depending on what publication or organization you're working for. And even as a copywriter, a commercial copywriter, you know, I'd be writing in lots of different voices. So whether it was, you know, sometimes it was like for the credit reference agency, you know, sort of industry, or, you know, like I had one client who made weird bits that go on ships and like in the engines of ships and things like that, you know, and you're just like, yeah, so there's all sorts of, and then sometimes you're writing press releases for people who want to hire a car to go somewhere nice in Italy or something like that. So your voice changes all the time, and I think that's great for writing fiction as well, because you can really tap into what makes that voice that voice, you know, like what is a formal voice, what is like, how does the language change? So I think journalism is a really great set of tools.
One thing you brought up there, because with all the guests we've had, and we looked at different backgrounds where people come from and various forms of education or not education that people have that have led them into the industry, I don't think literature is one we've ever had. Oh, we had one, but she's in communications. How has that helped you on your journey here?
Yeah, I mean, the same sort of way as, you know, the analytical thinking, and I suppose just having a broad sense of literature. I went to an international school, so I did the International Baccalaureate, and the literature program on there is really excellent because you do world literature. Whereas if I stayed in the UK, I would have just been doing Chaucer and Shakespeare and, right, you know, just like, and Dickens and all those things. But, you know, I did like Cry the Beloved Country, and I did Boris Pasternak, I did Dr. Zhivago, and, you know, and the program sort of studies literature that's sort of topical for the time. And so that was really great. So even that university, hopefully it's changed a bit now, and, you know, it's more of a global outlook on literature programs, hopefully. But so it just gives you a grounding in like the tradition of Western storytelling, right, depending on which literature program you do. But yeah, so for me, so it's like references to the Bible are in a lot of sort of European Western literature, and to sort of like Roman and Greek mythology and things like that. And and just like poetry, a sort of understanding of poetry and meter and rhyme, and just sort of a deep appreciation for language and how it's used, and the sort of, I guess, the history of storytelling. And, you know, games is now in that grand tradition of storytelling.
Yeah, I was just about to say, it's fairly cool that we've come to a point where all of that, that even if games have been trying, of course, to tell stories for such a long time, like coming to a point where really that kind of mm-hmm. education that you have mm-hmm. really like comes into play in video games.
Yeah, completely. Because, you know, when I was studying literature, you'd start with sort of Shakespeare and maybe Chaucer if you're doing a quite traditional literature program. Mine was a little bit more modern, sort of focused started a little bit later. So and then it sort of introduces the concept of the novel and what is a novel, and as we understand it. And so you read something like Moby Dick or something, which is considered an early novel in the Western tradition anyway. And then, yeah, so it's quite interesting to see how games fits into that, and, you know, sort of modernism and how that dismantled lots of things about the novel and took it to a different place, and theatre and modernist theatre and things like that, which, you know, games shares a lot. Yeah. With, you know, like how theater is aware of the audience and the interaction of the audience and how that affects and feeds into the performance. And so games and theater have this sort of close relationship that I think is sometimes overlooked in favor of cinema, because, yeah, you know, cinema is big and flashy, it's the glamorous one. But yeah, I think theater has a lot to offer us, and, you know, sort of people who write and work in theatre would be really cool people to attract to games, I think.
Yeah. The cultural studies student inside of me is waking up now. Oh, let's have a discussion about postmodernism and video games. Let's actually, we're going to dwell a little bit more on your background, because you touched upon it very briefly before I forget. A game. Mm-hmm. You were only two people that made it. Please just tell us a little about where that came from and how you got started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was more than two people, as we went on, but it started with just three people. We were thrown together at this game jam, and the theme was borders. It was an XX plus game jam, so it was for women and non-binary people, which was one of the reasons I signed up to it. because game jams felt like this intimidating space as a writer, a non-technical person, and you know whether people would laugh me out of the room. it's like look at this one, she's a writer. So I signed up for this game jam, and that's where I met Claire, and we kind of kicked around some ideas. There were lots of, Trump was threatening to build a wall. There was the Syrian refugee crisis was going on at that time. So there was lots of, topical issues around borders. And then I had this idea. I was just in a scrappy notebook of writing ideas that was about dementia. It was just that. It was just like person with dementia, question mark kind of thing. And so I was like, oh, I had this idea for someone with dementia for a story or something. I was like, how about that? How about if we look at psychological borders? And so that immediately gave us our setting and what type of person she would be, what her age range might be. And both Claire and I are interested in telling stories that games might not otherwise tell. And so, it just really worked for us. And so the ideas just bounced immediately. It's basically an exploration, a narrative exploration game. A little bit similar to something like Gone Home, where you walk around a house that's in grayscale until you interact with certain objects, and then color bleeds into that part of the world. And Sunita, it triggers a memory for her. So she is a woman with dementia, an Indian woman with dementia, and you're piecing together her life, and she's looking for someone called Dylan, and you're trying to find him by interacting with sort of fragments of her life. But because she has dementia, she's an unreliable narrator. So sometimes there are things that you know happened, but she's forgotten again. Right. We have a segment where she can't find the bathroom. She needs to go to the toilet. And so we use different techniques to kind of confuse and dismantle that idea of the play or games as a power fantasy, because you can't have that when you have dementia. So it's about sort of playing with the power fantasy of games, and so like on what stories they can tell by like looking at that dynamic.
Right. You started the idea and conceptualization came from a game jam, but you kept working on it afterwards.
Yeah. So we won the Audience Choice Award. So it was the one that everybody at the game jam was like, it was the one they wanted to see finished the most. And I'm 99% sure if that hadn't happened, we'd have gone like, oh, it's really nice meeting you. Bye. Right. that sort of like literally changed both of our lives. Because we were like, oh, should we try and carry on and see what happens? And so then 4 years later, we were nominated for a BAFTA in Game right. Beyond Entertainment, alongside like Animal Crossing, and like it was just like, what is happening? Which is where we had our launch party in Animal Crossing, because we launched in 2020. So yeah, we were a 2020 launch game. That's what you did.
I've received that that tip before, go to a game jam, be part of it, and as someone that has no technical skills either, it I agree with you, it feels just the idea feels intimidating. What am I supposed to contribute? You should still do game jams.
I mean unsurprisingly I recommend game jams. So
it'd be kind of weird if you didn't.
I think it can depend on the game jam as well. This was created by someone who was very focused on inclusivity, like even to, she was like, we're not going to work all night because people have kids and, you know, people they care for and things right. like that. And so it's not going to be this kind of crunch culture kind of game jam. And we'll have it at a certain time of day that makes it able to fit around like childcare and things like that.
Right.
So, yeah. And I think there are more game jams now that you can pick the ones that are going to be good for you, good fit for you.
Yeah. It's not just a young person's mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Good thing for me. but let's actually try to move over to your job here at NASA. Mm-hmm. I think we could talk about these things that we've been talking about now for a long time. The postmodernism thing is going to be a separate episode. How does a narrative designer, what does a typical day look like?
Mm-hmm.
You get to work in the morning.
Right. Get to the work in the morning.
What happens?
The one thing that always happens is I always open Jira. I always open Confluence. And so we always have stand up. That's a thing that happens every day, which is a very short meeting to just where you just get to know what everybody's working on that day. And then for me, a day could be, they're varied.
That's usually the answer we get. Yeah. Stand up, email,
right.
and then chaos.
Yeah, exactly. But it depends what stage of the project we're at, because if it's early in the project, then, you know, we won't be working on scripts yet. We'll be working on sort of paper design, so just sort of throwing ideas around for quest flow. And so there'll be meetings with the quest designer and our level designer to sort of carve this player experience for whatever beats we have of that part. So the overall story beats will be sort of thrashed out by the narrative director. And then we get that, so the bare bones of the story, so we know where we need to be sort of emotionally and in terms of the plot at certain points. And then we have our quests that we sort of design. So then we might have conversations with like audio, if we want to do something special with audio, like we want to follow a noise or hear a noise happening that interrupts something. And yeah, so we sort of intersect with loads of teams and like prop art and things like that. And then like later on in the project, we'll be writing scripts, and that could be all we're doing because deadlines might be tight. And so yeah, you're just sort of writing a script, getting it over to your lead. Well, probably the first thing I do is send it to the other writers, so like have a look, get some notes from them, then do like another draft or another couple of drafts, and then send it to my lead. And sometimes in those periods we'll have writing workshops, basically, where we feedback, sort of kind of a writing room scenario where we like literally sit and act out our scenes, which is kind of fun.
Sounds like a dream, really.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, I have to pinch myself quite often that, yeah, I get to do this. Like, talk about the minutiae of a fictional world, you know, like really seriously.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, how do they do this? and then, you know, we get to go to attend the mocap shoots, which is really interesting, and see how the cinematic director works with the actors, and have a movement coach, and which is really interesting watching that whole process for the actors and how they have the rig on and the mocap suit and things like that, and just how that studio functions. So that's really awesome experience. And also seeing your words finally come to life is amazing. And the sort of like ultimate reward. It's a really great moment. And then that all comes back and goes to like animators and audio people and brings it even more to life, and sort of layers on. Does that answer the day-to-day sort of?
It sounds like a very long day.
Yeah. But those are different days parts of the project.
I'm gonna do a shameless plug and go listen to episode 3 I think, Sue Kang from Cinematics talks a lot about how to work with the mocap and planning out the shoots and stuff like that.
Nice.
As a follow-up once you're done with this episode. But I think one thing to make a kind of a, because you're not a narrative writer, mm-hmm. you're a narrative designer. Mm-hmm. Kind of the difference there between a write, obviously you write a lot, mm-hmm. you write scripts, etc. But what's the difference there? What is it? Why is your job in another world? In another question, why is your job called narrative designer?
This is like the $1 million industry question. Yeah. Because every studio like calls, yeah, has a different definition for what a narrative designer is.
That's why there are so many narrative designer GDC talks available online.
Yeah, probably because everyone's trying to figure out. Yeah, because it's different in different places, but at least we work so closely. So the narrative designer is made up of two people essentially. So it's the quest designer and the writer.
Right.
So I'm narrative designer on the writing team, and we're all sort of buddied up with a quest designer for a particular quest, and together we are concerned with how to tell the story and how the player experiences that story.
Right.
And within a game, you have a certain number of tools that help you tell that story. And so those can be, depending on what your game is, full cinematic cutscenes. And then it can be, your gameplay verbs, you have investigation moments or... like whether you can speak to other characters, what you're doing within the world will sort of create constraints as to how you tell the story, but also shape how the player interacts with the world. So, right. Something like Mario, for instance, he jumps and, he has quite restricted, he doesn't speak. And right. So you don't have dialogue. That's not one of your storytelling tools in a Mario game, for instance.
Yeah.
It's all with sort of world design and audio and the beautiful animation and things tells the story. And then, with sort of a lavish AAA game, you have all the toys, which can create its own challenges, because then it's how to be discerning with those aspects.
Right. Episode 2, game design, we talk about gameplay verbs.
Nice.
I just want to learn more about that. Sorry.
I like that. This is what a narrative designer or writer on the team does, touches all the other ones.
Exactly. It's all been a continuation. It's a continuing story up until this episode.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a crescendo. What was I thinking about there? It's when having that kind of conversation, you talk about restrictions or possibilities or how gameplay comes into it, what you can do with those tools you're given in a certain project, be it a huge AAA or smaller indie project. What kind of comes first in those kinds of conversations? Game design, narrative design, story, how do those things come together when planning out the game?
Well, I suppose interesting. well, it's different, I think, on an indie project, or a very small project like Before I Forget, compared to a bigger AAA project. Or my experience of a big AAA project is that the story, the treatment for the story is already there. But then we have a very top level sort of beats for the quests. So it could be, I don't know, at this point they find the treasure in their grandfather's attic or something like that. But then it would be So I guess in that respect, the story comes first, but then it's when you get down to the nitty gritty, it's like, well, how do we get to the attic? Are there goblins on the ladder up to the, you know, like, right. you know, what, or whatever it is, you know, we try and decide like, what is the coolest way
yeah.
that we can get to the attic to get that treasure? And, you know, and we want the player to be doing something as much as possible, as opposed to, because we're not a movie.
Right.
We want people to play the game, not watch the game. So it's like, how can we make the most of, like, when we're using a cinematic, it's because it's going to be so epic and awesome that we couldn't do it any other way, that or it enhances what's just happened in gameplay to right. such an extent that it's just going to be super duper awesome and the player's going to be like, wow. So yeah, it just happens all together kind of weirdly. It's alchemy, what can I say?
Yeah, the reason I'm wondering is sometimes you have gameplay and if the story's there too, like you have the game designers and everything, it's like, this is how feature X works. Mm-hmm. If then narrative can come in, it's like, if we're going to justify mm-hmm. why this is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess then in some cases, narrative comes in like, okay, we need this feature to yeah. be able to enhance like finding the grandfather's treasure. We actually need this
yeah.
ladder full of goblins.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, it is. It does sometimes depend even on the quest.
Right.
Because, yeah, sometimes a quest is gameplay heavy, you know, maybe it has more combat in it or something, whatever it might be. And then, yeah, but it doesn't mean that the narrative or the storytelling is secondary. It's just like, okay, we're doing it this way. Yeah, so it's never like that story overrides gameplay. It's finding a way to balance those things yeah. so that they enhance each other. Which is like the cool, nifty challenge that we have every day. And it's hard.
Yeah, I think I think we talked to in that first episode, Anna, what I really like is, as an example of just like not justifying, but how these two things come together into one, is from Control by
mm-hmm.
Remedy.
Mm-hmm.
You have, okay, so we need all these kinds of weapons
mm-hmm.
that the character should use. But the setting does not really allow for all of a sudden I have a rocket launcher on my shoulder. But then everything just comes together inside one gun, mm-hmm. which is then used as a narrative tool to mm-hmm. kind of build the world around us,
mm-hmm.
Which I just found fascinating when you realize, like, okay, this is such a great way of marrying
mm-hmm.
gameplay with now I have a shotgun, now yeah. I have a automatic weapon, all in this one thing,
right.
while narrative gets to really shine and tell the story through it.
Right, yeah. I mean, like, Edith Finch has become a cliche to use as an example of beautiful yeah. marriage of gameplay and storytelling. Yeah, the sort of the fish factory scene, that whole sequence yeah. is just beautiful. And, you know, that you're chopping fish with one hand and navigating through the history of role-playing games in right. game design with the other is like what that whole sequence is yeah. basically, you know, because it goes from isometric to 3D, yeah, it's sort of fully realized sort of RPG type scenario, which is just like, okay, wow.
Yeah.
yeah, and it's beautiful when those moments happen. Yeah, and that's what you're always trying to strive to. You're always trying to be Edith Finch every day.
But you were discussing other teams like quest designers and you're talking to game design. How do you work with those different teams in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, with the quest design team, I mean, extremely closely. We're like two halves. Yeah. yeah. And so, yeah, that's really lovely. I love that. Like really close working relationship we have. And then we have a level designer. So it's really that trio of people. And then later the level artist will come on and just elevate everything. So it's like, yeah, the next time I play the quest, I'll be like, oh, wow, I've forgotten that it's not going to be gray boxes forever because you get so used to it. It's like, wow, this looks stunning. Yeah, so it's just lots of meetings, basically, and sort of brainstorming sessions and playing the quest together. So we'll sit and play through not even the whole quest. Sometimes it'll be like certain levels, because it might be different level design or own a level in the different part of the quest. So you'll sit and play through a level and see what's not working and what the solution is, and you know what the neatest way is, like if there's like a gap in the gameplay verb, so that we might have to do it with more dialogue, or you know find another way around it, or maybe there's a puzzle that we could get in here and things like that, or you know, like what's not working, like what are people not understanding about what we're trying to say here, or where we're trying to direct the player and things like that. So yeah, there's all sorts of ways that we help each other. It's like, oh, I need to convey this like emotional beat. Is there a cool thing we can do with gameplay? And then vice versa is like, oh, like players don't understand this bit. They can't make the connection from here to there. So could we have some dialogue that, or some storytelling that will help them go this way?
Right. So it sounds like you have to stay very, very flexible all the time. Adding, removing.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it's supposed to make sense at the end.
Yes. Yeah.
creating all of this, keep digging into your job a little bit. What kind of tools, like actual software tools, mm-hmm. you use to create these stories?
I mean, I think we're really lucky at Massive because we have Snowdrop and Oasis, and we get to write in the engine, which is really cool. So that we're in the same space as all the other designers, which is really great. And we sort of understand we don't understand, but we're in the same space. I mean, like I've seen people like be in the writing tool and they're just like, I don't know what's happening. Like, it's just like, what is this? So yeah, but it's nice to, we understand how the quest designers hook up the quests and things like that. And, you know, some writers in games are writing in Excel, and I feel sad them. Yeah. I feel so sad. How do they do that?
Yeah, I was actually shown a couple of examples of that a couple of weeks ago, and I was staring at the tools like, this is kind of insane.
Yeah, I know, this isn't right. No.
But what writing that, like talking about Excel and talking about the tools, like compared to before I forget, like, mm-hmm. what that. So, Chris, it's two huge different things. Mm-hmm. But what kind of tools did you use back then to craft that story?
Mm-hmm. So I wrote a lot of it longhand. I think I wrote all of it longhand, because that's one of the things about my process that changed from indie to AAA, because AAA, you just need to get it done. There's no time for, like, you know, sort of being lofty with my pretty notepad. So yeah, and because it was a game jam game, I was literally like scribbling it on a piece of paper. You know, I remember writing it sitting up in bed that night. I had some idea. So, and then I knew that some game writers wrote in Excel, but I couldn't imagine how they did that. So I ignored that and just wrote it like a film script in a Google Doc. So I did it that way. But then Claire, she wanted the lines. I think she did import them into Excel. I did want to use Ink by Inkle Games, but I just never got the time to kind of get my head around it for the integration into Unity and stuff like that. So
it's quite, Ankle is a very powerful tool for storytelling.
Yeah, incredibly powerful tool. So it would have had that learning curve that would have just slowed us down too much. Yeah. Just when we could have done, we just did it. Yeah, so I just wrote it like a script in Google Docs, and then it went into Excel. So it was all numbered. Yeah, so it went.
So it went into Excel other way.
Yeah, anyway. But I wasn't writing in there. I didn't do it. That's the crucial difference is like, yeah, I think I put stuff into Excel once and I put it in story order.
Yeah.
And Claire was like, can you not face because she was the programmer. She's like, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, you have to put it the robot way. Where it's like, I was like, oh, I thought it was being helpful, and yeah, it's yeah.
But this is a great example, actually. Even in a small project like that, mm-hmm. kind of the inner workings of yeah. narrative and, yeah, and yeah. gameplay.
I learned a lot from working with Claire just on that tiny project yeah. about the impact that something I write could have on like the animators, or it's like, you know, and then 1,000 dragons fly over the around the hill and the animation team just dies on the spot. You do learn to care about the implications for yeah. everybody else on things that you might really, really want.
Yeah. I asked you to put down a couple of points before we recorded this, the stuff you want us to talk about. We've been through most of it and more. But the last point you wrote down, which I love, is storytelling in games, challenges and joys.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk a little bit? What's the main, I actually know kind of the answer that you will get to this, but what are the main challenges
mm-hmm.
when creating?
Yeah.
Story
Well, I think both the challenge and the joy of writing games is the player.
that's the answer I knew it would be.
A challenge because you have to try and anticipate what they're going to do and what you know you don't want them to do. And, where you want them to go, ideally, if you could just, or, you know, what you want them to do. And so that's a challenge, sort of always trying to anticipate that. And, you know, that's a lot of what, the theory of game design and our jobs is like, how do we get the player to do these things that we want them to do because we've created this really cool experience for them.
Right.
And then part of the joy is you hand it over to players and then it's their game and then they run amok and, you know, they do something that you couldn't have anticipated. I mean, you know, even sort of GMs on role-playing tabletop role-playing will know this. They've crafted this beautiful scenario and then the players just do
way
something else.
Often.
Yeah, exactly. But then it creates these other beautiful moments and, you know, that sort of emergent gameplay, for instance, you know, create like moves the medium forward because it's like, oh wow, this is really cool, we didn't know they'd do that. And then it's like we can create games that can enable to do that, them to do that more, or right. And then it's like, how do we tell stories whilst they're just like running about doing whatever they like? And you know, it creates all sorts of like cool challenges and constraints and things to try and anticipate and solve, which is one of the great things about, you know, storytelling in games.
Yeah, you talked about that before with exploring and finding new ways to tell stories and actually finding out what video games can do. And I guess at the end of the day, it is about the player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how they actually, as a game writer, find out how the player will actually interact with whatever story you're trying to tell.
Right, yeah, because there's only so much you can do to try and, you know, sort of craft that experience, you know, unless you're telling a very linear kind of story, you know, like tight storytelling, like a Naughty Dog game or something. But even within that, I think, you know, the sort of like breakout combat moments, you know, there's some freedom to do it the way you want to do and, you know, like your play style and things like that. But otherwise, there's only so much you can do. And then you watch, which is why, you know, like play tests and, playing each other's quests and things is so important. And watching someone play your game for the first time is like, oh wow. I mean, you know, there were design decisions that we made in Before I Forget from watching people play the game that then sort of like changed the sort of gameplay pillar of the game, you know, one of the pillars, the design pillars. Like getting hands on the game is so important because you can see what people want to do or what they're not understanding.
Yeah, usually tell us the story to writers of video games when I was playing BioShock with a friend, and the dramatic moment. There's really like tight, fairly linear storytelling, and it is dramatic, and some of the big reveal. I'm like, oh, let's go! And I'm sitting there just ready to rush forward, and he just turns around and starts rummaging through garbage bins, and I was like, dude, we have. We're in the middle of this dramatic scene. We have to go that way. No, let's see.
Might be some fat loot in here.
Yeah, exactly. He comes in and yells at me at times, like, there's something shiny there. I don't care. The plot is this way. So it's just how you create drama for that kind of player. But I guess you just don't.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's one of the great things about... games is, you know, there's that experience for both of you, or having the experience you want to have. I mean, yeah, sometimes as a writer it makes you cry, like writer tears. They're just like, huh, I'm just gonna rifle through this bag of rubbish because it might have a shiny thing in it. But it's, you have to just accept that some players, that's not what they're playing for. The story isn't their reward. It's just kind of there, and it's something to kind of get past.
To get to the garbage.
To get to the rubbish bags.
If I'm for any writers out there, if talk to someone that's interested in writing for video games, mm-hmm. do you have any like tips or resources I could turn to?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of resources, I think definitely there's great GDC talks. And then in London, there's AdventureX, which is an event focused on narrative games. And it's incredibly well curated. So even the games that they've had in sort of expo that year will be awesome and interesting, but then they get incredible speakers. I think because there aren't narrative focused game events like that, or there's a couple more now, but it was the only one, so it would get really awesome speakers. Who else? There are blogs and things that I've just gone out of my head. But I turn to GDC talks quite a lot. The Game Makers Toolkit, they do really great stuff as well, unpacking game design a lot. It's not narrative focused necessarily, but it is it's really great to understand the other disciplines and how they work and how they fit with storytelling. I suppose read a lot, read widely. Go see theater. Analyze the stuff that you like. Why do you like it? I think look beyond games for your inspiration, and look beyond Western storytelling conventions as well for interesting ways to tell stories.
And play Before I Forget, 80 Days, and Overboard.
Yeah.
That's my
I mean, that'll be key.
That sounds key.
The Holy Trinity right there.
Call me Uncle. I'm right here. But thank you very much, Ella, for coming.
It's been really fun.
Been awesome.
Thank you.
I'm really bad at ending these things. Because like,
I think that's the ending.
Are we supposed to like shake hands and you know? Like,
they can't see us.
But thank you very much for coming, Charlotte. It's been fantastic.
It was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.